Today is Thursday, June 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden begins his first overseas trip in London.
This diplomacy is essential because no single nation acting alone can meet all the challenges we face today because the world is changing.
Plus, who was behind a deadly attack in Afghanistan that killed at least 10 people belonging to an international charity clearing landmines? And what countries are more likely to carry out state-sponsored cyber attacks? We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden landed in Europe Wednesday. It's his first overseas trip as the chief executive.
This diplomacy is essential because no single nation acting alone can meet all the challenges we face today because the world is changing.
Biden is set to hold high-level talks with other Western heads of state before meeting next week with Russian President Vladimir Putin at a summit in Geneva. Earlier, I spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman to get an idea of what a successful trip looks like for the president.
Well, President Biden himself has been talking about what he hopes to accomplish on this trip when he boarded Air Force One at Andrews Air Force Base before flying across the Atlantic. He said that one of the top priorities for him by attending the G7 summit and also attending a NATO meeting in Brussels is strengthening the alliances of the United States. At the G7 on Thursday, he is expected to announce a vaccine plan for the world as the entire planet tries to recover from this global pandemic. And this is a top priority, and it's expected to be very well received by the G7 countries and other nations as well that have been really clamoring for the United States to do more.
Another meeting that's getting a lot of attention this trip, Steve, is Biden's upcoming meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman responded to a VOA question during a question and answer video session at the German Marshall Fund of the United States of America on the issue of Russian crackdowns on critics.
We've also been very clear that when Russia abuses the rights of its people, as they have done repeatedly regarding Navalny, that we will speak up, that we will push back, that we will raise our concerns. We will try to bring the international community with us in that concern and to try to ensure that Mr. Navalny is safe.
Steve, what expectations have been set by the White House for this meeting?
Well, again, we've been hearing from President Biden at the start of this trip about that Putin meeting, the president's first stop after flying across the Atlantic was an address to U.S. troops and family members stationed at Royal Air Force Mildenhall. That's home to the U.S. Air Force's 100th Air Refueling Wing. And President Biden said, "I will tell Putin what I will tell him." That was sort of a vague comment, but it got cheers from the crowd. And then Biden said, "I'm going to communicate that there are consequences for violating the sovereignty of democracies in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere." He went on to underscore his belief that world democracies will not only endure, but thrive. And in a message which could be seen as a preface to his meeting with Putin and also a signal to Beijing, Biden said, "We have to discredit those who believe that the age of democracy is over." And he explained that though things are changing rapidly, he believes democracies can still get together to reach a consensus to respond to autocrats.
Is there anything else that the White House has said that the president is trying to achieve in this first overseas visit?
Well, I think also is critical is signaling a completely different direction from the presidency of Donald Trump, who focused on America first. That was the phrase, as well as unilateral relationships. Some went well, some did not, where Biden is much more embracing the traditional multilateral approach. And part of that is going to be really signaling to NATO that the United States is fully backing Article 5, where one nation of NATO would come to the need of any of the others who are attacked. So do look for a lot of that sort of rhetoric coming from the president in the days ahead.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House bureau chief. And as we just mentioned, first up on Biden's overseas agenda is the G7 summit, and Henry Ridgewell has this look ahead.
British warships are patrolling the coastline of Cornwall, while 6,500 police officers have been deployed as Britain prepares to host the leaders of the United States, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and Canada. The G7 summit in Cornwall marks Joe Biden's first overseas trip as US president. After 4 years of troubled transatlantic relations under former President Donald Trump, Biden will receive a warm welcome in Europe, says analyst Thomas Kleiner Brockhoff, vice president of the German Marshall Fund of the United States.
The attempt to rebuild trust, lost trust with allies, is at the heart of the agenda, and that message comes across loud and clear.
The scars have not fully healed, according to Kleiner Brockhoff.
There's a sort of a lingering suspicion that Joe Biden could be an outlier, an intermezzo between two nationalist presidencies, an America that has changed for the long haul.
Nonetheless, analysts say the G7 leaders will put on a strong show of unity amid numerous challenges. Creon Butler is a former British government advisor on the G7, now at Chatham House.
The COVID recovery generally is the top item, and you can see that, you know, in the way that the UK is presenting the summit.
Summit host Boris Johnson has pledged that the G7 will help to vaccinate the whole world by the end of 2022. Turning this rhetoric into reality is vital, says former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown.
I think it's no exaggeration to say that Friday's G7 is a life and death matter. Its decisions will determine who is vaccinated and safe and who remains unvaccinated and at risk of dying.
G7 leaders will also focus on tackling climate change. Trade and taxation, too, are high on the agenda. G7 finance ministers last week backed a plan for a minimum global tax rate of 15%. Again, Creon Butler of Chatham House.
So this bit is really quite revolutionary, as indeed is the agreement on sharing taxing rights around, so not just in the location where the tax residence of the company is, but also in locations where a company may have very large revenues but pay very little tax.
The threat from Russia and China to G7 democracies will also be discussed in Cornwall. Again, Thomas Kleiner Brockhoff.
The question as to whether Western countries can find a joint approach vis-a-vis China and whether President Biden can get the language and the commitment that he needs for also his domestic political purposes out of its European allies to make it worthwhile, in their view, the investment that he makes into the European alliances. That to me is the big question.
Several of the G7 leaders will go straight from Britain to Brussels for a NATO summit next Monday. President Biden is due to meet European Union leaders Tuesday. Analysts say the sequence of meetings is aimed at underscoring allies' support ahead of Biden's summit with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, in Geneva next Wednesday. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Officials in Afghanistan say that gunmen attacked the office of an international charity clearing landmines in the country on Wednesday. The attack killed at least 10 people and injured more than a dozen others. Ayaz Gul has been following the story from Islamabad and gave me this update.
Well, as of this moment, we have a lot of details, confirmed details, that the Islamic State regional affiliate in Afghanistan, which is called Islamic State Khorasan Province, has claimed responsibility for carrying out this attack. And apparently, they wanted to kill. There were 110 employees of this Hollow Trust charity a British charity. There were 110 employees, and these people, these attackers, they were masked, their faces were covered. They entered the building, and they basically asked the occupants that where are Hazaras in this building. And Hazara, we know, this ethnic minority Shiite community in Afghanistan, has been repeatedly attacked by Islamic State militants in the country. And this time again, they just went after them, and they massacred 10 of them. They killed 16. But in the meantime, it was interesting, as has been told by the chief executive officer of this charity to Voice of America, that the Taliban militants who were nearby that area where the attack occurred, and that area was controlled by the Taliban, but the attack occurred in an area which is controlled by the Afghan government. So the moment this attack started, Taliban insurgents rushed to the area, and that's why there were more than 100 people inside that building. So the attackers had to flee when they saw Taliban militants coming onto them. And so a lot of lives could be saved. And this is what this charity has said in its statement released to the media just a couple of hours ago. So again, as I said, that we know that Islamic State carried out this attack. And once again, this most persecuted ethnic minority of Afghanistan, the Hazaras, have become target of this deadly attack.
Ayaz, with NATO and U.S. forces currently withdrawing from Afghanistan, what does this mean in terms of trying to increase overall security in the country?
Well, that is a good question, but let me tell you, Steve, that since the American forces and their NATO allies started withdrawing from the country on May 1st, the only thing we have witnessed in Afghanistan is more violence, more bloodshed, because the Taliban have intensified attacks, and Afghan security forces are also retaliating with much more force. And in the last 1 month, it is really surprising. Hundreds of people, including combatants from both sides and civilians, have been killed. But what has happened and what was being anticipated widely is that the Taliban have gained significant ground in this fighting. And so far, what we know is in the last 1 month, they have captured more than 16 district centers in Afghanistan, like 16 districts. I mean, that is a serious blow to the claims of the Afghan government that their security forces will be able to contain the Taliban advances without the support of foreign forces. And we know that because the American forces were there, their air power was helping the Afghan security forces over the years. So they were able to keep Taliban at a distance from provincial centers, from urban centers. But what we have seen over the last 1 month is that Taliban have made significant battlefield gains and have captured at least 16 new districts. And that shows we are going to see more fighting, more bloodshed, more chaos. And that is a big question now. And there is a lot of criticism that maybe U.S. President Joe Biden has made a decision in a hurry by not putting any conditions on Taliban to reduce violence and make sure that the negotiations that they were holding with the Afghan government should produce some kind of a peace deal that could have brought this violence to an end. But that has not happened. The Taliban have been emboldened as a result of this withdrawal, and it seems that they are determined to regain power in Afghanistan.
Reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad. Some 200 bodies have been buried in shallow graves in and around the town of Hazan, Ethiopia, after 7 months of war in the Tigray region. As VOA's Heather Murdoch reports, residents fear the fighting will continue and more people will be killed.
Some mass graves in the Ethiopian town of Hausen hold dozens of bodies. Some hold only a few. Locals say there are about 20 graves in all, containing bodies that were found in the streets of the town after multiple battles. The most recent happened just a few weeks ago.
January The bodies lay out on the ground for 7 or 8 days, and there's no one to help us take them to the church. So a few of us buried them. They smelled bad, rotting, and attracting maggots.
Most Hausan residents have fled their homes, many to live in crowded camps without enough food. The town itself is in ruins. The families who remain say there is almost no way to make a living. Hausan has changed hands about 5 times since the war began in November between the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front and Ethiopian and Eritrean forces. Ethiopian troops now control most of the region, including Hausan. But fighting continues, and residents fear war could break out at any moment.
There have been so many bombings in this town. Children have died and houses are destroyed.
In the market, few sellers make any money these days, the woman adds, but they sit there all day, hoping for luck. On the outskirts of Hausan, Lete Gourmet says she doesn't expect much luck in this beleaguered town, as residents continue to bury civilians killed in war. She says among the dead are children and the elderly.
The killing continues. Recently, we buried another 7 bodies near the church.
This war has claimed thousands of lives and left millions of people displaced. Here in Hausan, some say they are no longer afraid because they cannot imagine anything worse could happen. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Hausan, Ethiopia.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says that it has helped more than 10,000 refugees, most from Central America, restart their lives in safer, economically viable communities in Mexico. Lisa Schlein has those details.
More than 70% of all asylum claims in Mexico are made in the south of the country, where job opportunities and services are limited. Consequently, the UN Refugee Agency started an innovative integration program in 2016 to relocate refugees into communities with better prospects. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says since then, the program has relocated 10,000 refugees to one of 8 cities in central and northern Mexico.
There, the labor and housing markets, as well as the education and health systems, have capacity to integrate refugees as a result of demographic transition and economic growth. UNHCR supports program participants with temporary housing, cultural orientation, vocational training, school enrollment, and job placement.
Baluch says the refugees can apply for naturalization in Mexico after 2 years of permanent residence. He says the program has been highly effective. A recent review shows 92% of the relocated refugees were formally employed, compared with only 10% in the south. And, he says, incomes on average were 60% higher than in the south. He says local communities also benefit from the increased tax revenues and social security contributions. He says the program has been a game changer for asylum seekers, the majority of whom are fleeing parts of Central America in search of protection and a better life.
The causes are well known: violence, insecurity, economic hardships, as well as the compounding effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, recurrent natural disasters, and climate change. In total, up to 1 million people in Central America have been forcibly displaced.
The UNHCR is increasing its target for the refugee integration program in Mexico. It seeks to relocate 20,000 people every year from southern parts of the country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Wednesday in the Czech Republic Senate in Prague, a Belarusian opposition leader called for the creation of an international tribunal to investigate war crimes allegedly committed by authoritarian leader Alexander Lukashenko.
We need this conference to unite our efforts to try to solve how to get out of political crisis in Belarus, how to start dialogue with the regime, and how to bring Belarus to new free and fair elections under observation of international organizations.
Svetlana Tikhanovskaya was Lukashenko's most powerful challenger in the Belarusian presidential election last year. Months of anti-government protests in Belarus were fueled by Lukashenko's re-election to a sixth term in office last August that was widely perceived as being rigged. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A new report published in the U.S. Army Cyber Defense Review asserts that every nation has been affected in some form by illegal cyber operations and that the severity of nation-state attacks will increase. Dr. Lance Hunter and Dr. Craig Albert are professors at the Augusta University in Georgia, as well as two of the report's three authors. I began our conversation by asking lead author, Lance Hunter, about the key findings in the report.
So what we're looking at in this paper is really what factors are influencing if states initiate cyber attacks against other states. And so the key findings in this paper are that power, military, economic, and industrial power are really the main factors influencing if a state's likely to initiate a cyber attack against another state. And then also in another level of analysis, we find that more authoritarian states, less democratic states, are more likely to initiate cyber attacks against other states. So really the main findings are that power, both economic, military, and industrial, are very important when states initiate cyber attacks, along with regime type, if a nation's authoritarian. That tends to be some of the major factors that we find in this study.
Dr. Hunter, a quick follow-up question. Are you surprised by your research findings that authoritarian-led governments are more likely to carry out cyber attacks?
I would say it's not surprising. One of the things that's a little surprising is the level. We see the authoritarian states are significantly more likely a lot of times to carry out the attacks than democracies. So the level is a little bit surprising. Democracies do carry out attacks as well, but authoritarian states more so. So I would say it's not a surprise, but the level by which they're more likely to do it is a little surprising.
Speaking of surprising, Dr. Albert, since this is one of the first kinds of studies of its kind, what did you find surprising in the results?
One thing that I was interested in discovering was if less powerful states would use cyber attacks against more powerful states, because that was a debate in the field between policymakers and even congressional staffers and academics, was it kind of a balance of an equalizing balance? So would less powerful states that had access to tools in cyberspace use that against more powerful states that had more military power? And the literature suggested that could be the case. But what this study shows is that that's not the case. And that really surprised me. What we see is that as in traditional kinetic or regular conventional warfare, more powerful states are more likely to use cyber attacks or to initiate cyber attacks. And the study also suggests that their relative power is about twice as much as the states that they attack. So that's showing you that not only are more powerful states likely to initiate, but they're more likely to initiate it against way lesser powerful states.
So, Dr. Albert, then what are some of the takeaways from this report to help governments create policy to better protect themselves and their citizenry?
What we're looking at is that it seems that all policymakers should be aware of authoritarian regimes initiating these types of attacks. So that's something the United States National Security already is aware of. But also it's something that burgeoning powers or rising powers or perhaps even revisionist powers may look into for policy and for predictive analysis, is that they're likely to come under attack by the status quo power, by the power-maximizing state in the international system. So in other words, any lesser powerful state that wants to make a move on the system needs to be aware that they're likely to face a cyber attack from a more powerful authoritarian state in the future. And that's something states can wrap their foreign policy around and make sure that they're secure. And of course, we can predict the states that are more likely in this data set to initiate those actors. But this is the first study of the type to really say that this is the case.
And one last question, and I'll let you both respond. What other recommendations have you been able to make as a result of this research?
Sure. Sure, absolutely. I would say two things related to that. One is looking more so at how regime type, the level of democracy or authoritarianism a state is, influences cyber attacks. We have another related project where we're looking at that a little bit further to see really how the type of government structure a state has influences the likelihood that they will carry out these attacks. That maybe could help pinpoint where these attacks are more likely to come from. And then also the motivations behind these attacks, because in a related project, we're looking at the motivations, and a lot of these attacks are espionage, some are sabotage. And when we're thinking about if a democratic state attacks another democratic state or authoritarian state and vice versa, we're starting to see patterns there versus if it's espionage or sabotage. So what we see, if democracies attack other democracies, it tends to be espionage more. But if democracies are attacking authoritarian states, it tends to be sabotage a little bit more likely. And then authoritarian states are a little bit more likely to carry out sabotage at times rather than espionage.
Another interesting point is to study the counterattack. So will states be more likely to counterattack from a cyber attack with kinetic means or with cyber means? And that combination is called hybrid warfare, and that seems to be what national security for powerful states seems to be trending towards. And in the U.S., of course, our national security strategy document states that we reserve the right to respond kinetically to any cyber attack. So that's interesting, and that's really the deterrent factor against, like, Russia or China, for instance, from doing something massive, is that we retain the right to attack back, you know, using conventional missiles, for instance. That's public information. It's out on our strategy document.
Dr. Lance Hunter and Dr. Craig Albert teach in the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University, and along with Eric Garrett, authored their report, Factors That Motivate State-Sponsored Cyber Attacks, in the U.S. Army's Cyber Defense Review. And finally, Facebook's recent decision to ban former President Donald Trump for 2 years sends a message to world leaders that Facebook is stepping up its role as sheriff on its service. VOA's Tina Trin has that story.
They may allow me back.
With Donald Trump suspended from Facebook for 2 years, experts say the social media company is sending a message to world leaders and public figures that Facebook will no longer give them preferential treatment when their speech breaks its rules. David Green is the Civil Liberties Director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
What it means for other world leaders is they're not going to be treated differently solely based on their status as world leaders.
Along with Trump's suspension, Facebook rolled out a new policy saying it'll crack down on any world leaders' postings that could lead to harm or violations of its community standards. Previously, Facebook would leave content from public figures up, arguing that there was a public interest, even when that content violated its policies. Some critics say that the guidelines are still too vague and a 2-year suspension of Trump too light, and sends a message that the door to Facebook is always open, even for serious offenders. Sheree Mitchell is a member of a group called the Real Facebook Oversight Board.
The fact that they're leaving this as a suspension means that the other world leaders are on pause too, a little bit, right? That means that maybe, just maybe, they may have an opportunity to continue.
Facebook says public figures who eventually return will face increased penalties for repeat offenses, ranging from 1 month to 2 years. Only cases deemed extreme will result in permanent suspension. Nick Clegg is the vice president of global affairs at Facebook.
It doesn't matter who you are. You can be the Pope, the Queen of England, the President of the United States. You cannot use our services, and I hope most people would think this is reasonable, to aid, abet, foment, or praise acts of violence.
While the company has set up an independent oversight board to review its content moderation decisions, some experts contend that the oversight board itself is a deflection. Faiza Patel is the co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program.
My sense is that they're using that as a way to deflect from more serious issues around, you know, what their algorithms are doing to spread certain kinds of information.
If the internet has come a long way in the last 25 years, shouldn't internet regulations too?
Over the past year, Facebook executives have called for government to play a larger role in determining the rules of the internet. Again, Nick Clegg.
American democracy does not belong to Silicon Valley. It belongs to the American people. And the people who should set the rules for how American democracy plays out and where the line should be drawn on what speech is and is not acceptable shouldn't be private companies.
While Facebook will look more critically at world leader speech, what's certain is that the scrutiny of Facebook itself won't let up anytime soon. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
In related news, Nigeria has banned Twitter after the social media company deleted a message posted by President Muhammadu Buhari saying the tweet violated the platform's terms of service. Former President Donald Trump released a statement congratulating Nigeria for those actions. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. And on behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.